No. Thanks, Dougie. Tonight's theme. What is tonight's theme? Well, we've been sort of looking at what are the things that we experience that point us to the existence of God. Like last week, remember, we were looking at beauty. I've got to move this slightly further over because otherwise I can't see. So we looked at beauty. Remember, Nikki sort of took off and painted these fantastic pictures of all the things she finds beautiful as pointing her to God. But if all these things point us to God, what's he like? And that's tonight's theme. So what's God really like? And I've got an exercise for you to do. Yeah, we're still sort of above five at some tables, but hey, we'll see how we get on, okay? We'll see how we go. For this exercise, it's self-explanatory. Discuss the following statements, and then mark, there's quite a few statements. So you've got to talk about it. Giving you a heads up now. And then mark them in order of how right or wrong they are. Where 0 is very good and 100 is very bad. Okay? Shall I read out what they are? Here we go. There's a slide, actually. Let's have a slide. So I'm going to hand out these pieces of paper. And I've even got a pen. One minute. And counting. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Shh. It may disappoint you to know that I'm not in any way interested in what you've written down. But isn't it amazing? I've never heard you so talkative before all the times we've been over here. I don't think there was a single group where everyone didn't have something to say about one of these things. And really, the reason it's a good exercise to do because it shows us how complex the whole issue of right and wrong is. But it also shows us that everyone here in this room has a very keen sense of right and wrong, because you've all got something to say about it. And so tonight's question is, where does that really keen sense of right and wrong come from? Tim Keller, in his book, The Reason for God, uses this phrase, moral obligation. He describes this sense of right and wrong as our sense of moral obligation. Okay? And here's a quote from his book that defines what that means. So listen carefully, and you get some idea of what we're talking about. Moral obligation is a belief that some things ought not to be done, regardless of how a person feels about them within herself or himself, regardless of what the rest of his or her community and culture says, and regardless of whether it is in her or himself's interest or not. So it's this sense that despite what I feel or what my mates think or what the television tells me is right or wrong, there's something beyond that, something out there that I know from that whether something shouldn't be done, whether something's right or wrong. You know, it's something out there that's telling me. That's what Tim Keller talks about as our sense, our innate sense of moral obligation. You know, why do we have human rights? Why do we talk about human rights? And if we do, where does that concept come from? So that's tonight's question. And here's this fellow called Professor Alan Dershowitz. Okay, let's have the next slide up, please, Derek. Professor Alan Dershowitz. Where does our sense of right come from? Where does our sense of moral obligation come from? He says, well, there's three possibilities. It comes from nature, it comes from culture, or it comes from God. So very, very quickly, I'll go through these three things, and then I'll talk about what this tells us about what God is like. Okay? Obviously, I think it comes from God. So that's just giving you a heads up before we get there. Okay? So there's no surprises. But the idea that it comes from nature, it really means that we're all animals, so it's built into our DNA. You know, it's something to do with being an animal. It's built into our nature. And that sounds quite a reasonable thing to assume until you actually stop and think about the animal kingdom. Because the animal kingdom is not a very fair kingdom. Basically, in the animal kingdom, the fox always gets the rabbit. Okay, the fox doesn't say, oh no, I don't think it's fair for me to eat you today. The fox always gets the rabbit. I know, because we had a rabbit that was got by a fox. There's a phrase in the animal kingdom that says, nature is red in tooth and claw. Lions always will eat antelopes. Doesn't matter how defenseless antelopes are. They, oh, you poor wee thing, I'm not going to eat you today. Yes, I am. And even more disturbing is what happens among certain spiders. Ooh, I hate spiders. But the praying mantis. Does anybody know what happens to the mate of the female praying mantis once the business has been done? She eats him. She eats him. Okay. Is that nice? No. So there's a lot of questions over this whole idea that our sense of moral obligation comes from nature. There's not actually all that much evidence in nature of it being a nice, fair, kind, you know, compassionate place. Second place where our sense of moral obligation might come from is from culture. And this argument, could someone switch off that machine at the back before it starts up again? They switch it, thank you. This argument goes something like this. Yes, you may get the odd person who's really nasty, who's a bully, who's a psychopath, who's a pedophile, who's a sociopath, you know, all that sort of thing. But the majority view generally determines what is right or wrong. In other words, if everybody's agreeing that something's wrong, then it's wrong. If everybody's agreeing that something's right, then it's right. So we're getting our sense of right and wrong from the people round about us. Now, the disturbing thing about this is that, to a greater or lesser extent, that is often the case in our lives. You know, if our mate says it's okay, oh, well, it must be okay, so we go and do it, even though there's a sense, oh, I'm not quite sure about it. Oh, no, that's fine. Lindsay and I spent a number of years living in a culture that believed in caste. Caste is quite an insidious thing. It says you are born you're born into a certain class because of something you did in a previous life. So therefore it's your fault. So therefore you deserve as good as you get. So if you're born poor, it's your fault. And so therefore you can be treated as if it's your fault. And caste divides a whole society into layers, where at the top you get the people who are really nice in the last life, and at the bottom you get the people who are really horrible in the last life. And the people who are really nice treat the people who are really horrible really horribly. Because obviously it's not their fault they're born like... See what I mean? It's quite an insidious thing. Yeah, that's right. But it's a system it's accepted by most of Indian society, where we were staying at the time. So just because the majority believes it, doesn't mean to say it's right. An even more extreme example might be some of the things that happened in the 30s and 40s in Europe, in Germany. It was like the state said it's okay to do these things, and the teachers taught that it was okay to do these things, and the whole economy was based on people doing these things, so people were living off it, taking property away from minority groups like the Jews, like the Gypsies, or like people who were physically or mentally handicapped, just doing away with them. You know, because it's for the common good, the state said. And the whole of society swallowed that whole. But it wasn't right. Doesn't mean to say it was right. And I would argue that doesn't matter how much we try and obscure things with excuses or rationalizations or justifications, we know in our hearts when something's wrong. And it doesn't come from the majority view. So that just leaves another option, the third option, which is that it's something to do with God that has supernatural origins. The Bible tells us that God made us in his image. In other words, every single person in this room has the imprint of God on them. There's a spark of the divine in each of us. And that's where this sense of right and wrong comes from. It's because God's like that. And we're like God. And Tim Keller says, you know, because of that, we all have a choice. We either just deny it, which means we're living in denial of God, or we face up to it. And it points to the reality of the existence of God. Just even our sense of right and wrong is a clue about the existence of God. So there we have some good evidence. Our shared sense of justice, our shared sense of moral obligation is evidence for the existence of God. But the question then is, what sort of God is God? Clearly he's a just God, because we have a sense of justice. So we can start there. He's a just God. But there's a problem with that, because if God is a just God, and we know he's a just God because our sense of justice comes from God, see, here I am, if God is a just God, then he must believe that if you do something wrong, you have to pay for it, because that's also part of our sense of justice. You know, I don't know about you, but I hope that the people who did those awful things in Paris on Friday night, when they meet their maker, which they all have done already, have had to pay for it. Have had to pay for what they've done. I leave that with God to do, because it's not my job to judge them. But I have a strong belief in justice. So along with that strong belief in justice comes this sense that if you did something wrong, then you can't just get away with it. And I think we all have that strong sense of justice in us. We say, that's not fair. They've got to pay for that. Someone's got to pay for that. That's not fair. They can't just get off. You know, that these are phrases we use all the time. So that's the problem with the sense of the fact that our God is a just God. Because if he's a just God, then part of justice means that, you know, if you do something that's horrible or wrong or nasty, then it's only fair that you pay for that. So how does he see us? If he is completely just, how does he see us? I mean, hands up if you've lived a perfect life. Hands up if you've never done something nasty to someone. Hands up if you've never, you know, said something that has made you out to be good and made someone out to be not so good. Hands up if you've ever just sort of, you've been cutting up the pizza and you've given yourself the biggest slice. See what I mean? So if God is a just God, and we know he's a just God because of this sense of justice and, you know, that we have, then we've got the problem. And it's a problem that people who acknowledge the existence of God have to deal with. And if you look at the way the different world religions approach this problem, you see that they try and deal with it by having this sort of, I call it a balance. You know, in their minds they've got a balance that on this side is all the bad things I've done, so I've got to make up for it by doing lots of good things. And somehow if it balances out, I'll be okay with God. And if you look at most world religions, you find that's the system they're based on. So how do we get the balance right? Well, we obey the 5 laws of Islam, or we obey the 8 rules of Buddha, or whatever. You know, you've got to somehow gear your life towards redressing the scales so that somehow a just God will look upon you and say, okay, they've served their time, they've done their thing, so it's all right. And the problem with that is, how can you ever be sure that you've done enough? And so you end up living a life that, if you ask a Muslim, can they be assured of salvation? They will say, how can I possibly be assured of salvation? And they'll fess up to that. So they will never have peace in their life. They're just hoping that they've done enough. And that's where Christianity is different. That is where Christianity is different. Because as Christians, we know, and the reason we know this is because God has shown us this. Not in nature, not in beauty, not in our sense of justice, but by becoming one of us and revealing himself to us. That's what Christians believe. That's why we're called Christians, because we follow Christ, who we believe is God. And so Whatever we see Jesus doing, we know is God doing it. Whatever Jesus says, we know God's saying it. And so in Jesus, we have a sort of window into what God's really like. And when we listen to what Jesus says about God, he says, yes, he's just. But he also says that he is loving. And I want to just illustrate that for you by reading a story from the Bible. And it's a story that you probably all know really well. It's from Luke chapter 15, and I'll read it from the Message, because I hardly ever read anything from the Message, and I thought this would be a good excuse to do it. Okay, so here goes. So sit back and listen to this story. Now, this is Jesus telling us what God is really like. And you've got to be asking yourself the question when you hear this story, is this just? Is this loving? Jesus said, there was once a man who had two sons. The younger said to his father, Father, I want right now what's coming to me. So the father divided the property between them. It wasn't long before the younger son packed his bags and left for a distant country. There, undisciplined and dissipated, he wasted everything he had. After he'd gone through all his money, there was a bad famine all through this country, and he began to hurt. He signed on with a citizen there who assigned him to his fields to slop the pigs. He was so hungry, he would have eaten the corn cobs in the pig slop. But no one would give him any. That brought him to his senses. He said, all those farmhands working at my father sit down for 3 meals a day, and here I am starving to death. I'm going back to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son. Take me on as a hired hand. See, he's got that sense of the balance there. He knows he's blown it. He knows he's done far too much wrong. He can never possibly repay him. He knows he's blown it. So he's going to go back and say, I'm sorry. I know I've blown it. Just take me on as a servant. So he got up, right up, and he went home to his father. When he was still a long way off, his father saw him. His heart pounding, he ran out and hugged him and kissed him. The son started his speech. Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son ever again. But the father wasn't listening. He was calling to the servants. Quick, bring a clean set of clothes and dress him. Put the family ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Then get a grain-fed heifer and roast it. We're going to have a feast. We're going to have a wonderful time. My son is here, given up for dead, now alive, given up for lost and now found. And they began to have a party. So far, so good. But there's a problem. All this time, his older son was out in the field. When the day's work was done, he came in. As he approached the house, he heard the music and the dancing. Calling over one of the houseboys, he asked, what's going on? The houseboy told him, yeah, it's your brother, he's come home, your father's ordered a feast, barbecued beef, because he has him home safe and sound and he wants to celebrate. The older brother, faithful brother, the one who hadn't asked for his share, the one who'd worked the farm all those years, stalked off in an angry sulk, refused to join in. His father came out and tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't listen. Look how many years I've stayed here and served you, never giving you one moment of grief. But have you ever thrown a party for me and my friends? Then this son of yours, who's thrown away your money on women, shows up, and you go all out with a feast. His father said, son, you don't understand. You're with me all the time. Everything that is mine is yours. But this is a wonderful time, and we had to celebrate. This brother of yours was dead, and he's alive. He was lost, and he's found. And the story stops there. We don't know what happened. And it's a lovely story, but it's actually a story with a problem. Because when you stop and think about it, the older brother is right. The older brother is right. You can't just take half the family wealth and go and blow it
And then, oh, you're feeling hungry, I think I'll go home again.
Come back home again and be treated as if you haven't done anything wrong. You can't do that. That's just not fair. That is unjust. You see, God, our God, the God that Jesus talks about, is loving, but he also has to be just, because if he's not just, how could we ever trust him with anything? You know, I mean, how could you ever trust a policeman who lets people off with things? That's not fair. You wouldn't trust him anymore. If God lets people off, if God lets off the people who did that stuff in Paris, would you trust him? See, it's a real problem. It's a real dilemma. God is got to be loving, and he is loving, but he's also got to be just. Now, in the Christian faith, there is a solution to that problem. And you probably already know what it is, or you're probably already working out what it is. And we'll be looking at it more in depth in a couple of weeks' time, when we look at the death and the resurrection of Jesus. But in the meantime, I want to leave you with Jesus' own words. Can we have the slide, Derek? Jesus says, "My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." We all share a sense of justice. And the only place it can reasonably have come from is from God, who made us in his image. So we are just because God is just. But God is calling us to be loving too. And that can only happen through self-sacrifice. That can only happen through self-sacrifice. So here's a thought just to finish with. It's quite a challenging thought. Just in a few moments' silence, I want you to try and imagine, you're not going to share this with anyone, just try and imagine someone who has really hurt you. It could be something way back in your past, or it could be something that happened just this last week. Okay. Now, remember, you're made in the image of God. So I want you to see if you can do this. I want you to just imagine that you're looking at that person through the eyes of Christ. You're looking at that person through the eyes of Christ. What do you see? What do you see? Because remember, that's how Jesus sees you. Lord Jesus, we thank you that there is nothing that can separate us from your love. And you've proved that for us on the cross. And if there's someone here tonight who has yet to experience the greatness of your love for them, my prayer is that you would show them how much you love them right now. That you'd come in the power of your Holy Spirit and just give them a glimpse of how much you love them and how much it's cost you. See, this is amazing grace. This is what we sing about. Let's sing that final chorus now.